Peter B. Collins. News and comment on Thursday, May 23rd, 2013. Obama announces some changes today. Will it be change we can believe in?
Still don't know what I was waiting for. And my time was running wild. A million dead end streets. And every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. Well, I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Your humble host is reporting to you about 30 minutes before the president makes a long-awaited speech at the National Defense University. I'll have full commentary on the speech as it rolls out tomorrow. And it is occurring at National Defense University. I misreported yesterday, based on news accounts that I was referring to, that it would occur at the Naval Academy at Annapolis. And I do apologize for that error. And I eagerly await what the president has to say today. My cynicism, my jaded perspectives on his administration aside, I hope that real change is announced in the drone program, in true transparency regarding the legal basis for the president's targeted killing program, and that real moves are made to clear the decks at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and eventually close the gulag there. Now, I'm going to temper my expectations because that's what I've learned to do with Barack Hussein Obama. But my aspirations continue despite that. It is reported that he will announce restrictions on the use of unmanned drone strikes, shifting control away from the CIA to the Pentagon. And that's not necessarily all good because the Pentagon doesn't have to report its drone strikes to the Intelligence Committees of Congress, which is currently required of those conducted by the CIA. Not that that oversight results in anything, but it is a shift with a consequence. And to prepare the way for this, as we reported yesterday, they announced that a fourth American was killed in a drone strike in Pakistan. We'll get to the story of Jude Mohammed in a moment. And it appears that the president will announce, a la George H.W. Bush, a kinder, gentler drone strike and targeted killing program, if that's not self-canceling. He apparently will essentially impose rules that he has apparently used in targeting American citizens on those outside of declared war zones like Afghanistan. This could mean an end to the signature strikes, attacks on groups of unknown men based on the aerial surveillance that they're carrying guns or that they are gathering in ways that appeared to suggest that they were militants. Now, the president is also expected to announce a new effort to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And activists like my friend Andy Worthington have noted that over 400,000 new people signed a petition just in the last 48 hours urging the president to close the prison. He can start with the 86 individuals who have been cleared for years, including those from Yemen. Most notably, I hope that Shaker Amer, the last British prisoner, is released and very soon. But we don't know how far the president will push in the authority that has been curtailed by Congress, but nonetheless permits him to release people from Guantanamo. And we'll just have to see if he does reappoint a high-level State Department official who works to place people in third nations. That post has been vacant for the last 6 months or so. And I'd love to see him take more aggressive steps, but he seems cowed by the Congress and unwilling to do so, so we'll see how it all turns out. Now, this is interesting. In the advance that was leaked to the New York Times, and this is a leak that will go unpunished, it's expected that the president will reject the notion of perpetual war with terrorists. Now, this comes just days after a Pentagon official said, well, another 10 or 20 years at least. And Jay Johnson, the former counsel at the Pentagon, has said that at some point we do have to say that the war against al-Qaeda is over. You can't decimate it and continue to fight it week after week, year after year. And, of course, with that goes the rollback in our civil liberties and the whole war posture that you hear me rant and rave about on a regular basis. So I will look forward to this speech, and I will have my comments for you tomorrow. There's one other element related to the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, and that is that, mysteriously, the Justice Department yesterday dropped an effort to throw out a California lawsuit seeking documents related to that killing. So this could be part of the recalibration that the president will announce today. And anything that lifts the level of police state we have now will be welcomed by me. Jeremy Scahill issued a statement following the announcement of the fourth American killed by drone strikes, and I want to quote from it. Jeremy, of course, is the guy who wrote the book about Blackwater, and he has a new documentary film that'll be in theaters on June 7th called Dirty Wars. He said, Attorney General Holder's letter raises more questions than it answers. While the Obama administration now admits it intentionally killed Anwar al-Awlaki despite never having charged him with a crime, it continues to insist that the evidence against him is too sensitive to be made public. The assassination of al-Awlaki was a watershed moment, crossed a dangerous line. The public has a right to know the full legal basis for killing an American citizen without providing him any access to due process. How would al-Awlaki have surrendered when he was not even charged with a crime? How do you surrender to a drone? Scahill continues. In his letter, Holder says that the U.S. didn't specifically target 16-year-old U.S. citizen Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki. What does that phrase mean? Why then was he killed? The White House should explain his killing to the American people and the boy's family. Despite its claims to be the most transparent administration in history, the Obama White House continues to keep secret from the American people vital information about its claimed legal authorities. How does an American get on the kill list? How does one get off the kill list? Especially when there are no criminal charges filed against you. And one more site here. He goes on, perhaps most disturbing about the Attorney General's letter is that it leaves totally unexplained why the United States has killed so many innocent non-American citizens in its strikes in Pakistan and Yemen. Yet from my investigation on the ground in a variety of countries, I've become convinced that we're making more new enemies than we are killing terrorists. We must confront the realities of the full impact of our targeted killing program, particularly when innocent civilians are killed. And to that point, the New America Foundation released a study the other day showing that only 2% of those killed in all of the drone strikes under Bush and Obama were reported to be known militant leaders. May I repeat that? Only 2% were reported to be known militant leaders. Under Bush, 40% of those killed were reported to be civilians or could not be identified. And under President Obama, this report says that number has fallen to 16%. Still, 16% is way too much when we try to promote the false notion that these are carefully targeted killings based on solid intelligence information. That simply is not the case in the vast majority, up to 98% of the drone strikes we have launched. Yesterday, after the Holder announcement, actually a letter sent to leaders in Congress, I heard news reports that got it wrong, and it just floored me. I was driving home listening to an ABC affiliate as the top-of-the-hour newscast led with the drone strike report, and ABC Radio incorrectly reported that the young al-Awlaki was killed in the same strike with his father. I got on the phone, called the network newsroom in New York, and tried to straighten them out. They weren't terribly interested, I have to say. Then I flipped on the TV while I was cooking dinner, and Rachel Maddow inaccurately reported that Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki was killed in the drone strike that killed Samir Khan. That's not true. Samir Khan died in the strike with the elder al-Awlaki, the first one, and the son was killed 2 weeks later in a separate strike in a very different part of Yemen. And the American media, I guess, is just so unaccustomed to reporting on these issues that we've been talking about here for years. And it floors me that they can't get it right. There were four victims of three different strikes, and yet the information was inaccurately presented to people who are probably hearing about it for the first time. It really bugs me. So now to that fourth victim, Jude Kenan Mohammed, an American citizen, 18 years old, born to an American woman and a Pakistani husband. He'd been living in Raleigh, North Carolina. And based on unnamed sources, the New York Times reports that he came under the influence of an older man, Daniel Patrick Boyd, who taught him a violent, radical version of Islam. Boyd was eventually imprisoned as the ringleader of a group of North Carolina residents who had vowed to carry out violent jihad in the U.S. and overseas. And Mohammed was charged in that case, but apparently had already left for Pakistan, where, again, with an unnamed source here, it's reported he joined a group of militants in that country's tribal area. He was killed on November 16, 2011, in a CIA drone strike on a compound in South Waziristan, and at that point he was 23 years of age. It was a signature strike, and it was reportedly he died with about 12 other insurgents. Again, insurgents, what do we know about that? From the sky, we can't really tell that. But again, this unsourced allegation appears in this article in the New York Times. So, we learn a little bit about this guy, but they say, this is curious, because Rachel Maddow really emphasized this part in the initial report on this on her program on Wednesday. She noted that the FBI was still listing Jude Mohammed on its most wanted list, even though he's been dead for, what, 2.5 years? Or is that a year and a half? I'll straighten that out later. At any rate, it's been quite a while, and his name is still on the FBI's most wanted list. Apparently, they pulled it down from their website late yesterday. And then the Times, with the first quoted source being Seth Jones, a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation and former advisor to the military Special Ops Command, he is the source for this comment. Mohammed was not directly targeted. He had come under increasing scrutiny by American counterterrorism officials who said he was involved in recruiting militants for al-Qaeda and the Pakistani Taliban. That's a far-fetched claim. Jones also indicated that the reports are that Mohammed had made contact with five young Virginia men who disappeared from their homes in around Thanksgiving 2009 and turned up seeking to join militant groups in Pakistan. So that's the jacket, as they say, the file on that dead American. And again, he was killed without any due process whatsoever. The New York Times editorial today is on target. It says, you know, all this Benghazi investigation has been focused on the State Department and bashing the State Department because, of course, it was led by Hillary Clinton at the time. But the editorial reads, we now know that the CIA, not the State Department, originated the talking points that Republicans wrongly insisted were proof of a scandal. And not only that, it was the CIA that first wrote the drafts of the talking points. And later in the editorial, it says, the wrangling occurred because the CIA annex was a classified operation. In fact, the CIA was the main American presence on the ground in Benghazi, had relationships with local groups, was supposed to have the best fix of what was going on. It's their security failures, the CIA's security failures, that should be scrutinized, and not really the State Department. And that shows just how this is a political witch hunt, not any kind of a legitimate investigation. Over on Fox News last night, I spent a few minutes with Sean Boy Hannity, and he trotted out Michelle Malkin to offer blistering, broad-brush indictments of all people who embrace Islam. This is based on the brutal attack in London of a man who appeared to be a military officer. And he was brutally hacked to death on the street by two men with butcher knives. One of them gave an interview to a passerby who fed that video to the media, and Fox News picked it up. And it's really atrocious. He's standing there with a butcher knife. His hands are covered in blood. And he rants on about the British government. And he did utter an Allahu Akbar. And so that appears to be enough evidence for Fox News to say that this was an Islamic militant jihadist attack. I'll wait for more information here. Because there are crazed people who use religion as a cover all over the world, not just Muslims. I doubt if this will come up in the president's speech today, but he's also got the rampant problem of sexual abuse in the United States military. And we learned yesterday that a sergeant at the military academy at West Point is being charged for a shower cam, allegedly videotaping female cadets without their consent, sometimes when they were in the shower. He is Sergeant First Class Michael McClendon, and I think it's good that stories like this are surfacing. It shows that people are no longer tolerating this kind of outrageous behavior in the military. Disturbing news from Connecticut. The legislature there has secretly drafted a bill to block release of photos, tapes of 911 calls, and death certificates related to the Newtown Elementary School massacre, the Sandy Hook School, last December 14th. And apparently the governor is ready to sign this legislation that would really keep secret a lot of the evidence related to that mass killing at the elementary school. And they say that this is because of truthers. And I guess we have to come up with new labels for truthers because, you know, I'm a 9/11 truther, and I don't shy away from saying that in any way. We don't know the truth about 9/11. I await it eagerly. And there are serious questions, at least based on the conflicting real-time media accounts of what happened at Sandy Hook on December 14th, and the official narrative that has surfaced. And one of the elements of this new state law that may be signed shortly is that the town clerk in Newtown, Debbie Aurelia, would be able to continue to withhold the death certificates of the first of the 21st graders and the six adults who were killed there. And I'm not the kind of truther who says, oh, this was a hoax event or a false flag event or a black government operation intended to fuel gun control legislation. I don't believe that. But that doesn't mean that I have to accept the inaccurate and incomplete, sometimes incoherent, narrative of the events of that day. And the corporate media just closes ranks. Shortly after events like this, they lock down on whatever the story is at that point, and anybody who challenges it is a truther. And to have laws passed to block access to public information simply raises another red flag and feeds the conspiracy theorists in this case. I was in Portland a couple of weeks ago and noticed the active campaign over a ballot measure that would have permitted fluoride to be added to the drinking water in Multnomah County. Yesterday in the special election, that measure was defeated by a wide margin, 60-40%. Now, I think people have the right to control their drinking water at a local level, and I think this is the democratic process at work. But I also think there's a lot of anti-science fear-mongering about fluoridation. And that's what I saw in the campaign in Portland. And when I grew up in Cincinnati in the 1950s, it was the John Birch Society that was against fluoridation, these really radical right-wingers. And they felt that it was a communist plot to poison the American populace under the guise of protecting our teeth. I'm not sure who's being blamed in Portland, but I think that fluoride is safe. And I think that people ought to just get over it. And finally today, I'm going to link to a blogger from ValleyWag at Gawker.com because they have located the document about that started Apple's hidden Irish tax scheme on the 6th of August, 1980. I mean, this goes way back. And they filed papers for a company which was called Waldwill Limited. And now it is Apple Overseas Incorporated, I think, is what they... Apple Operations International, AOI. And it's fascinating to see the origins of the tax avoidance schemes of Apple Computer. And it does sully the reputation of St. Steve Jobs just a little bit, doesn't it? I think so. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast, and you are personally authorized and encouraged to share it with at least 100 other people. Well, start with a handful, okay? Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.